This is case number 50851, Terrence Bowser versus the State of Nevada. And we're ready. Mr. Reed.
Mr. Reed, before you get started, I had a procedural issue that I could ask you about, and Mr. Pesci as well. In the Fifth Amendment issue, the motion to suppress, the Judge Gates heard. I was looking for the transcript of that hearing, and I couldn't find it in the record on appeal. So I don't know exactly what his rationale was for admitting the confession and determining that I guess it was voluntary or whatever sequence of events happened. And legally, where does that leave us from an appellate standpoint if we don't have that in the record? And that's really kind of an important issue here.
Well, let me start with the first part, which is that I think we should obviously supplement the record and make sure that's there. These were daily transcripts because at the time it was a capital hearing, so I cannot believe that there is not a transcript of that proceeding. So I think we should provide it for the court's edification. Okay. I can only tell the court my best recollection from a couple of years ago as to the court's finding. It was a two-part decision. There was a voluntariness aspect to it, and there was also an Edwards versus Arizona aspect to it. If I can outline it for the court briefly, what transpired was at the crime scene, it was a detective by the name of Sullivan that initially made contact with Mr. Bowser. Mm-hmm. Subsequent to his arrest, Mr. Bowser made the statement, "I'm going to make you work for it. I'll see what my attorney can do for me." At least that's what the officer said, words to the effect of as what he recalls.
Okay.
It's our position that at that time was an unequivocal request for counsel. We have an objective observer, that being Officer Sullivan, who said, "I stopped questioning at that time because of this unequivocal invocation of the Fifth Amendment privilege." Subsequent to that, Detective Wilson from Homicide initiated the contact.
How much time elapsed between that?
Off the top of my head, I know it was either that day or the following day. It wasn't a lengthy period of time, but there was a period of time in between the arrest and when Detective Wilson makes contact with him at the Homicide office.
And he didn't Mirandize him then?
He did Mirandize him again.
And he said what?
And he confessed to the crime. And there's two pivotal parts that he confesses to. Mm-hmm. One is he admits that he was involved in bringing the shotgun shells to the scene, that he was participating with the co-defendant in that regard. And more importantly, he says that during the course of the shooting of the decedent, he says the words, "shoot, shoot." So two very damaging parts to his statement. He also initially, in the eyes of the detective, lied to him about it being a fight between the cars, that it was just a situation on the highway, road rage situation, and then eventually admitted that he was being untruthful about the road rage situation and confessed to the participation in the crime.
Okay. Thank you.
And if I can, just a shortcut that, since we're talking about that issue, Justices, the way I see it is the main focus there is this court has to decide, is that statement, "I'm going to make you work for it, I'll see what my attorney can do for me." If that is an unequivocal statement, you have to suppress because we know there is police-initiated contact, and it's irrelevant whether Miranda warnings were subsequently given and the rest.
Well, let's assume for the sake of argument we agree with you here, and I'm just posing these out for both sides, these questions, and we did agree. Could we look to the totality of the evidence, excluding the confession, to determine if there was sufficient evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to convict Mr. Bowser of the murder with use of a deadly weapon?
Well, let me make sure I understand the questions, Justice Gibbons. Are you asking if you can apply harmless error to the admission of it, or if you're asking can you look to the totality of the circumstances of the confession to determine whether it was
answered any way you'd like?
And how does Chapman relate to this? Yeah. In other words, use the Chapman standard.
Okay, look, first, yes, absolutely, there is, this court can determine that it is a Fifth Amendment violation, but that it is harmless error under this set of circumstances because it's an Edward versus Arizona argument. On the second part of it, because we're saying it's an unequivocal invocation, when Detective Wilson reinitiated the contact, the voluntariness of the statement and the evidence concerning the Miranda warnings becomes completely irrelevant.
Wong Sun comes in, poisonous tree.
Absolutely. So did I answer the court's question?
You.
That's our position.
Thank you.
I was going to start my argument with talking about another issue in the case, which has to do with the situation on the shotgun and the shotgun being tested by the jury. If I can briefly for the court outline what happened in that regard. We had argued diligently for a second degree in this case. This is not a situation where we're asking for an acquittal, but for a second degree. The real issue in this case, from the defense's perspective, was whether or not there was premeditation and deliberation. Now, we know going into this, only one juror would be enough to be able to say, if there's a lack of premeditation and deliberation proven beyond reasonable doubt, then they have to consider a second-degree conviction. To compound the issue, the only actual evidence of measurements and distances between these two cars was a flashlight that was stuck into the door of the victim's car. The prosecution, during their closing argument over our objection, which was sustained in part and denied in part, actually sat with the shotgun in chairs and maneuvered the chairs around the courtroom, where there was actually no testimony as to distances, angles, or the sequence of the shot, and proceeded to explain to the jury the exact sequence of those shots, despite the fact that there was no evidence of that, and moreover, even simulated a conversation between the two co-defendants, which never took place. And of course, we objected to that. That becomes even more complicated when the jury goes out, they begin their deliberations, they spend the whole day deliberating, the day of the verdict. Around 3 o'clock, a notice passed saying, in essence, we want to know how fast the gun can be fired. And as this court all knows from doing, all trial judges here, the procedure is the mechanism on the gun is locked for safety reasons. So the bailiff, excuse me for a second, the bailiff takes it on his own volition to remove the safety seals from the shotgun, goes back into the courtroom, back in the deliberation room and says to the effect of, you know, tell me what you want me to do. And again, his testimony was, how fast can you fire the weapon?
Well, when the judge got the note, did he not call the lawyers?
No, he didn't, Justice Cherry. This all happened before Judge Gates was aware of that taking place.
Wait, you're suggesting that a question came from jury, that a bailiff responded to the jury's question?
Yes, Your Honor. So the bailiff on his own, before Judge Gates even knows what's going on, is doing what I've just led the court to. That goes further. They talk amongst themselves after he dry fires the shotgun a few times and ask if he could do it in the seated position. He obliges and does it. Now, after that, he takes the note to Judge Gates, who notifies the attorneys, and we come down.
Then what did you do after you were notified that the bailiff did this on his own?
We objected. First and foremost.
Did you move for mistrial?
We moved for a mistrial, secondly. Now, Judge Gates' way to cure it was, the bell's been rung. Now he wants to ring the bell louder. So by ringing the bell a little bit louder, here's what he decides he's going to do. We're going to go into the courtroom. We're going to have the same demonstration occur in the courtroom to compound the issue, again, over our objection. The way it starts off is, I cannot describe it any way but bizarre, is the jury comes into the room and the first thing that Judge Cherry tells counsel,
Judge
me in
Gates.
This room, Judge Cherry, I'm so used to having you as a trial judge.
I make my own mistakes.
This wasn't yours. Sorry, Judge Gates. He asks if the attorneys, myself and the district attorneys, want to handle the gun, you know, demonstrate with the gun, and I immediately say no. I mean, it would be very inappropriate for me to be up there handling the firearm in front of the jury, not to mention that just kind of looks really bad. So then he does it again, and I tried to do the best I could to put on the record exactly what the bailiff did for the jury. He asked the jury, is that okay? Are you happy with it? And then summarily denied our motion for a mistrial. Now, the prosecution concedes, and I can tell by the smiles on the justice's face, this is absolutely inappropriate. They concede that, but the state's position, and I think where Judge Gates was going to, is, if I put it on the record again, you know, in front of the God and the lawyers, then it'll cure the defect because the real issue was notice. But that's only a part of it. I mean, if we were given notice, we would have had the opportunity to come in and say, first and foremost, don't do it. Don't supplement the evidence. And that's a very compelling argument for him to send that note right back and say, the evidence is the evidence and decide the case. Second option is, which is basically what the state's saying, but the way they're explaining it will not work. Option two is the note gets passed to the judge. The judge says, okay, here's how we're going to do it. We're going to remove the shotgun shells from the room. We're going to unseal the gun. We're going to hand it to the jury just like any other piece of evidence, and they can do whatever it is they do with it. Or they can stay, you know, the bailiff can stay in the room, not participating, to make sure that they, you know, don't do anything foolish. There had to be only two ways that this could be done. Way number three is the way it was done. There just isn't really any other lawful way for this to take place. Now, there's another aspect to this too, which is, if assuming this court finds that that's a reasonable, you know, that he exercises discretion in doing that, we're in a bit of a pickle, because now we can't go back and argue to the jury the facts and circumstances of what the bailiff did. We can't go back and supplement the evidence or hire our own expert. This is a really critical aspect of the case, because their witness, who is a specialist by the name of Krylo, testified as to the trigger pull and how the shotgun fired, but no one ever actually fired it. We have a bailiff that is operating under the cloak of the court. He's the right hand of the court that is now in front of this jury advocating premeditation and deliberation for the state in a way that we cannot come back and challenge. To compound that even further, we don't just do it once, but we do it again a second time. There's another fact to that that's really kind of problematic. As the court already knows, obviously, that the bailiff is post-certified and skilled in guns. That wasn't put on the record. I asked for his height and weight to be put on the record, and the judge just glossed over that when I made that request. Never admitted, denied, or put that on the record. The co-defendant, who's the shooter in this case, let's not lose sight of that. Co-defendant, we don't know his height, weight, ability to fire a gun, whether he ever handled a shotgun before or not. I mean, this was opening Pandora's box. And I know as trial judges, we sit there and we're at the end of a trial and there's a huge mistake made by our bailiff. Initially, it was a capital case at the time, but it's still a murder case. And they have to make that decision. You know, can I pull the plug on this case at this time? Unfortunately, Judge Gates had no other choice. And what he did just compounded the matter further. And unless the court has any specific questions.
Did you offer any limiting instructions on how to view this bailiff misconduct?
No, I did not offer a limiting instruction. I'm not sure what it is, Justice, I would say. And no, the state did not offer any instructions. All they did was analogize it to this. They said this is just like a 911 or a photograph. This is not like a 911 or a photograph. This would be like the 911 operator coming into that jury deliberation room and saying, ladies and gentlemen, I've been a 911 operator for 20 years, and here's what you do in an emergency situation, and here's what I was saying on that recording. Or a CSA, a crime scene analyst, going in there and saying, when I took that picture, I was 22 feet away at a downward angle, and I took 14 pictures instead of 12. I mean, the court gets my point. If they drop the shotgun on the table and they test it, that's the jury's right. But when you add the arm of the court, basically filling in the blank for premeditation and deliberation, we have prejudice.
If we follow what you're saying in reverse on that basis, should we still, does the appellate court still have to reach the issue on the voluntariness of the confession, since another judge would probably be hearing the new trial?
That's an excellent question, Justice Jarrett.
I thought it was too.
In either regard, we're going to have to refile that motion. I think the court would probably be suited to address that issue so that when this comes back, if a trial judge has to face that, this court already has an indication of whether it feels that the statement is admissible or inadmissible, as I cannot see how there could be any new evidence that could come to light based on the totality of the circumstances.
Well, the evidentiary hearing could be different, as the question that Justice Gibbons asked about time frames and stuff that may not have been brought out by you or Mr. Pesci in the evidentiary hearing on the motion to suppress. It could be different.
I agree. That's why I started with, in either regard, as an appellate advocate and as a trial advocate, I think I'm going to have to refile that motion and address it again.
Anything else you want to reserve your 1 minute and 18 seconds?
I would. Thank you, Justice Jarrett.
Mr. Pesci.
I'd like to pick up where you just left off and build on what Justice Gibbons said at the beginning. First of all, there is absolutely a transcript of that hearing. Your justices, your honors, have that. I would direct your attention to the appellant's appendix, appendix, page 2789. Specifically, defense counsel in...
I'm sorry, what is that now?
2789. In fact, it's quoted to you in the appellant's reply brief, if I'm not mistaken, saying that, quote, Detective Sullivan ceased his questioning of Bowser because of this unequivocal invocation. With all due respect, I completely and 100% disagree. And I direct your honors specifically to page 2794 of the appellate's appendix. And in the suppression hearing, and by the way, Justice Terry, I would say argue that there should not be a second one, because it would be, in essence, a second bite of the apple, and I'll get to that.
Law of the case is what you're saying.
Yes. Because Judge Gates did a very, very lengthy hearing. Judge Gates, the district court, saw the witnesses, heard the testimony, could assess the credibility of these individuals, and let's start with those individuals. It's not a detective. It's not Detective Sullivan. What do you think of? Think in your minds right now. When you hear Detective Sullivan, you're thinking, well, the detective on the case, the detective that's going to interview this individual, that's the person that got the statement. It's not the detective. It is a patrol officer. He's Officer Sullivan. He's the backup to Officer Smith who makes the first stop.
So does that make a difference?
Yes, it does, Justice.
So in other words, if I say, Mr. Patrolman, I want an attorney, and I'm oversimplifying it, then because he's a patrolman, it doesn't mean that the questioning needs to immediately cease?
Not at all. But the context of what actually happened is what's important in the light of the patrol officer. Because this is what the patrol officer actually testified. This is the testimony at the proceeding, the suppression motion. The questions were asked, what did he say? He, Bowser. Miranda is given by Officer Sullivan, and he makes the statement you just heard of. You got me. I'm going to make you work for it. I'm going to see what my attorney can do for you. Specifically, Mr. Reed asks on cross-examination, what did you, Officer Sullivan, think that meant? And Ms. Jimenez and I were not the deputies at the time. We inherited this when we set for trial. The deputy at the time objected, saying his subjective reasoning was not relevant. And Judge Gates overruled and allowed the response. So defense counsel was able to ask that very officer what he interpreted that statement to be. And this is the actual testimony which came in. The witness, Officer Sullivan, basically, the reason why I stopped asking Mr. Bowser questions is because I was there to assist. It was Officer Smith's case. At that time when he said that, I basically closed the door, and it's translated as seized. I think he meant seized. All questioning. I didn't want to step on the feet of Officer Smith, so I just left it at that. Not I thought that this was an unambiguous and unequivocal invocation of his right to remain silent or his right to an attorney. It was neither, straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
So it's your position what Kaczmarek applies here in the statement was kind of iffy about the right to counsel, so therefore it was proper for the Mirandizing him the next day and then questioning him.
Correct. And in fact, this happens after midnight. At this point, the victim is not deceased. Detective Wilson, the homicide detective, doesn't even get involved until, I believe, after 7 a.m. the next morning after the defendant's been incarcerated and after it's now a murder. And so they go up and give Miranda again. But as far as the ambiguous or unambiguous, let's go to what Judge Gates actually said. And keep this in mind. I mean, I practiced in front of him for quite some time, tried quite a few cases, and I don't think I've ever heard him say something like this about the police. This is on 2831, Appellant's Appendix 2831. This is his ruling on, one, the voluntariness, and two, whether he invoked his right to remain silent and or to counsel. This is Judge Gates who heard the testimony. He, in fact, was read his Miranda rights by Officer Sullivan, and after acknowledging that he understood them, or because he started to make the statement, and the statement, as I understand it, according to Officer Sullivan, is, quote, you guys got me, I'm just going to have to see what my lawyer can do for me. Now, that in itself doesn't, to me, is ambiguous, and it doesn't say that, quote, I want a lawyer, so I'm not going to talk to you until I get a lawyer. He should have said, quote, I don't have anything to say, I want a lawyer, I don't have any statement.
You're quoting Judge Gates here?
Yes.
Okay.
I didn't have any statement, leave me alone. This is all Judge Gates in his ruling on the suppression when he denied it. He goes on to say, he didn't say any of that. First of all, he made an admission, quote, you got me. That's an admission right there. Then he goes on to say, I'm going to see what my lawyer can do. That can be read as not saying you want a lawyer. That can be read as saying, see, look, you guys got me, so I'm going to have to hope my lawyer can get me out of trouble or whatever. But that's not a direct statement, unambiguously and unequivocally asking for a lawyer. So that's what the officer said. That's what the district court judge who actually saw the evidence said. And he goes on, in addition to that, just to be on the safe side and to make sure they gave him his Miranda rights again, and at no time did he indicate that he wanted a lawyer. In fact, he gave a 70-page statement, which indicates clearly that he didn't want a lawyer, and he wanted to make a statement. So therefore, looking at the totality of the circumstances, the statement was freely and voluntarily given. He didn't ask for a lawyer. They didn't deny him a right to a lawyer. And this is what's really telling. When you consider Judge Gates, who, and this is very respectful, I say this, was not known to be an advocate for police. He says, I think they did everything right this time. A lot of times they don't in terms of advising them of their rights and giving him an opportunity not to make the statement. Therefore, the motion to suppress is denied.
But do the totality of circumstances include that this guy was the passenger in the car and not the shooter? I mean, should we ignore that fact, too, when he's saying, you got me, let's see what my lawyer can do?
As to whether he was invoking his right to an attorney?
Yes. If he's a shooter, it's one thing. He's not the shooter.
It doesn't matter if he's a shooter or the driver. Each of them have the right to invoke counsel and invoke to remain silent. I don't think it changes.
No, I'm talking about when we look at totality of circumstances as to somebody who... As to trying to figure out what this guy's trying to say. I mean, these guys are not rocket scientists when they talk to the police, as I found out.
That's true. People that choose to, but they have a right to do that. But if we look at it in the context of him, let's look at the facts, Justice. And I take exception with what's been put forth in the appellant's appendix, that there was, quote, nothing to show that he intended the murder occur. With all due respect, the defendant confessed to telling the shooter to shoot. So if we look at the totality of the circumstances, it is the driver, who's now before you, who tells the shooter to shoot. And that is the evidence that came in this case. So if you take it under that prism and look through it through that prism, that factor goes to the fact that this is voluntary, that he didn't invoke his attorney, and that he didn't invoke the right to remain silent. And going to the totality of the evidence, he's the one driving the car. He admits that he followed the victim. He admits that he pulled up next to the victim. And the evidence is he told the shooter to shoot.
The shooter was the passenger. The driver was the defendant here.
Yes. I apologize.
And I mixed that up. It was my fault. Okay.
And factually speaking, from your perspectives, Your Honors, if the cars are heading towards the outer door, the victim's was on your right, the defendant's was on your left. And the cars were pulled up such that the driver positioned the shooter in the passenger side on the very side where the victim was driving. So the driver, Mr. Bowser, who's here before you, put the shooter in the perfect position to actually fire that lethal shot.
Okay. Mr. Pesci, would you agree that our standard of review is whether there's substantial evidence to support Judge Gates's determination?
Correct. There's been no showing of an abuse of discretion. There's no way you can look at that.
Wait, what about Chapman?
What about Chapman in that sense, Justice?
Because the standard review isn't abuse of discretion. It's beyond a reasonable doubt and a constitutional issue. This is a constitutional issue.
My response to that, Justice, is that in reading his response and what he said, there's absolutely no way to view it in any other way than what he said. And so even under that standard, this statement comes in. And I don't think they get a second try if we get to the gun issue, which I'll do in a second, but I know Justice Slater had a question.
Yeah, my question was having to do with the positioning of the vehicle and the intent that would take this crime up to the first degree, the intent to do so. Your suggestion then is, or that he acted with premeditation, your suggestion is then that by driving in the manner that he did, he is the one that placed the parties in the position that allowed for the act.
Yes, because the cars were moving. And in fact, the victim was not quite dead when the police first arrived, and he made some indications that he did not want to go directly home to bring them to where he lived and to his family. And so there was some degree of driving around, and in fact the evidence came in that the appellant Bowser said that they were driving around for 30 to 40 minutes. To cut against the argument that it was just to shoot into a car, they had 30 to 40 minutes driving around the greater Las Vegas area to pick a car. Pick a car on the side of the road.
And to position themselves in a, where they would be doing more potentially than shooting at a car.
Exactly.
Mr. Pesci, what about this demonstration? It seems like there's some issues here. What do you think about that?
All right.
I like your smile.
turning to the shotgun issue. A note was given to the bailiffs. Eventually, both sides were informed of this situation after the demonstration was done back in the jury room.
What did the bailiff tell the jury without the knowledge or permission of the judge?
There's no evidence of what he said back there. You just heard something about test firing. There is evidence that he did perform that after they asked. Now think about it in this context. It is a secured weapon. There are live shells back there. They did the appropriate thing in asking him to make it safe. They have the right to examine the evidence. Let's set aside a 911 call. Let's say it's a mask that someone was wearing during a robbery. They have the
Mr.
right...
Mr. Pesci, you're not going to honestly argue that this was an error to have the bailiff going back there doing a demo, for God's sake.
Well, what I'm arguing is that it was probably not the best situation on earth. But what did happen is afterwards we came back on the record. And think about it from this context.
And did it again.
Yes, absolutely. Because, and I'm not being facetious in this part, they have the absolute right to work with, touch, utilize that evidence. They can do that. And so that in and of itself is not the problem. If the argument is, which was in the briefs, which is different than you heard today, in the briefs it was a Sixth Amendment argument as far as confrontation. By coming back out, their Sixth Amendment was honored. The defendant had the opportunity to ask questions of the bailiff and ask the jury, is that the way it went? And they had that chance to follow up with questions. It was a reenactment of what happened back there. And if you look at the reenactment, in and of itself, as far as manipulating the gun, there's nothing by itself about manipulating the gun that is a problem.
But they didn't have an opportunity really to decide how the demonstration was going to be in the jury room. In other words, there could have been a negotiation between the state and the defense to say, this is what we'll let the bailiff do if they had known about this. But the bailiff decided to make his own religion here and go in there and show up.
There is no doubt that we were not present for that first
time. We don't fault you at all for that. It's certainly not the state's fault.
But when we came back out, it provided the opportunity for the defense to pursue whatever avenue that they wanted to follow up on the concerns that you just mentioned.
Well, I think the avenue was to move for the mistrial and then to try to do something once the mistrial was denied to make the situation a little more fairer, even-handed. It wasn't even-handed. I mean, I'm having trouble seeing that it's even-handed.
Then to go to that issue of the even-handedness and looking at the facts of this particular case, this was not a whodunit. So let's follow up on the height and weight of the co-defendant. What does the height and weight of the co-defendant matter as far as dry firing a gun or firing the gun live in the factual scenario that the defendant even admits to? And the defense was, I did this, it just wasn't first degree murder. So how fast you pump it, depending on his weight and his height, really doesn't make a difference in the concept of these are the two people that did this, and whether or not it's first or second degree murder, how fast Green could pump it doesn't matter in the context of Bowser says, shoot, and there were three shots that were fired. So, I mean, if there was something to the issue of one of these shots was possibly from Bowser, that's not it at all. That's not it at all. And it's not a question of did, in fact, Bowser shoot, because the defense made hay of the fact that the state made a deal with the co-defendant. So it wasn't even that issue that he's the shooter. He is the shooter. His judgment of his guilty plea came in. He admitted to premeditatedly shooting him. So there's really no actual prejudice that comes from the dry firing and the reenactment of that particular shotgun situation.
So if we say that no harm, no foul in this, every defense counsel is going to have to ask if a weapon goes into the jury deliberation room, so that this can't happen again. I mean, that's what I would do as a defense attorney.
I think that's a good idea. I don't think this creates precedent that makes them have to do that. I think it would be wise, obviously. And I think that the majority of the times this doesn't happen, I hope.
Well, usually the bailiff tells the judge that got a note from the jury.
It looks like my time is running.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, I think, Mr. Reed, you have a minute and 18 seconds.
Sorry, no, I'm trying to get you wrong.
Take your time.
First, on the suppression, it's an objective view, and there's no question in the record that Detective Sullivan, officer, whatever, ceased questioning, and we also know that Smith never questioned him. Now, Justice Gibbons mentioned Kazmarek. In Kazmarek, it was undisputed that it was a different crime that they initiated the question about, which is a distinguishing fact, I believe, from what happened here. This is the same crime. On the other part of the argument, which is the Sixth Amendment issue raised by Mr. Pesce, I don't recall that we ever even used the word Sixth Amendment in that argument. I think which constitutional amendment is a little bit irrelevant when we know it's an error. His second point is there's nothing in the record. It's actually on page 8. The bailiff, I went into the courtroom and asked them how they want me to do it. What did they want? And they said they wanted me to pump it as fast as I could fire. So I did it in the air. And they spoke among themselves for a few moments. And then they said, well, can you do it sitting down? And I said, yeah. I sat down, same as I did here, right in the record.
Was that Roy? Was that the bailiff?
That's Roy.
Okay.
Height and weight is a factor. Me shooting the gun versus Justice Seda, I think a little bit of a difference. The admission of the co-defendant never happened at trial, Justices. That was only at penalty hearing for the purposes of the death penalty. It was never brought up at trial. I'm out of time.
Sure, go ahead.
A quick question. The positioning of the vehicle by your client in order to effectuate the ultimate event that caused death. Any comments you want to make about that as to whether or not it rises to the level of his premeditation and the first degree versus second?
My comment is that how that gun was fired and the angles and distances is critical to whether that's premeditation or deliberation. Because what Mr. Pesci's forgetting is under Sharman and Bolden, my client, Mr. Bowser, has to have the specific intent to kill. And obviously the jury was struggling with that because they know they have to prove beyond reasonable doubt that he had the specific intent to kill coupled with premeditation and deliberation. If it is him swinging the gun up the middle and he starts firing and our guy drives away knowing now there's a firing, it's a big difference between a planned, deliberate, knowing attempt that he pumped that gun and methodically shot it, pumped that gun and methodically shot it again with pauses in between. There's a big difference there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sweet, Mr. Pesce, as always, excellent arguments, good briefs. And
just Chair, I just want to say I didn't find that in the record. Obviously, it's in the record. I think it's been read in, and sometimes we have to kind of struggle to find everything, but I'm sure I can find it now with the pages.
Well, if you'd like me to provide a copy, we'll send one.
I would. If for some reason it's not there, if it was Justice Cherry's permission, I would ask that we put another copy up. It's probably there. I just probably missed it. So, again, I apologize.
Your Honor, can I provide give him a copy?
Send it to all three of us, please.
Yes, is that okay with the state?
Yeah. Okay. Send it to all three of us as soon as possible. And go ahead.